Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about.
I am Nicolas Maduro, re-elected president of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela.
There you have it. Maduro declares victory, but the U.S. State Department says, damn him. That's not what we wanted. We spent all that money to get him out, and he still won. What's going on here? This is Direct Impact. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. So let's start with this. It's been roughly a week now, more or less, right? About a week since Kamala Harris unofficially took the reins of the Democratic Party as their candidate instead of President Joe Biden, obviously, who said he's not going to run after Mr. Obama told him he had to get the hell out. That means that Kamala Harris will now be facing off with ex-President Donald Trump, and now we can finally see how this race is shaping up. Remember, I told you we had to wait at least a week for some of the polls to come in? Well, some of the polls are coming in. Here are the polls that we are going to be looking at for the next several months. They're all aggregate polls, by the way. That means they combine a bunch of different polls. Real Clear Politics, that's a good one. That's one you should look at from time to time. It shows Trump with a 1.7% lead, 47.9 to 46.2, as you can see. Now, let's look at the New York Times. New York Times is another very good aggregate poll. I think they do a really good job in their polling. They don't use one poll. They use a combination of about five or six polls. Also has Trump ahead by 2 percentage points. That's 48 to 46. Let's look at one more. What do you say? All right, Victor, put that one up too. There it is. Finally, there's The Hill. The Hill does a good job with their aggregation of polls. Shows Trump 48%, Harris at 45.9. So in this one, he's winning by more than 2 percentage points. So here's why this is important, and here's where we are. Basically, after watching Trump go way ahead after his assassination attempt, and then watching Harris catch up to him after Biden stepped down, now it's all kind of shaking out. You know the expression we use in mathematics, regressing to the mean? Regressing to the mean means it goes back to where essentially it's kind of supposed to be. That's kind of the way life is, too, in many ways. So essentially, we're back where we were before, with Trump still winning. To be fair, Harris is doing a little better than Joe Biden, but she's not doing a lot better than Joe Biden, but she's doing obviously better than Joe Biden, who, you know, God bless you, God bless him, is, you know, himself not doing all that well. So that's kind of where we are right now. Manila, you got anything on this? You want to chime in on this?
Absolutely, Rick. So first, we got to say, like you said, it's only been 1 week.
Right.
It's fair to say that we are still in the honeymoon phase of the new Kamala Harris campaign for POTUS. So people are energized at the moment until we start getting into the nitty-gritty about her history, her time as VP, her accomplishments. What have they been? Was she the border czar? Wasn't she the border czar? What were her failures, her wins? And once people start digging into that, I think the emotions are going to kind of quell, because according to 538, which we know is a great prognosticator about different horse races across the United States, right? Even internationally as well, but specifically here in the U.S.
Yeah,
and they're really good job.
And they're looking at the battleground, by the way. I was sharing the general the poll of all Americans, and with 538, what they do is they break down states. So that's, in the end, will end up being more important, right? To your point.
And what they have to say is that her disapproval ratings as of this weekend are hovering at about 53% disapproval. So even though some of the polls are showing that she's closing that gap, narrowing the gap between the Democrats versus Republicans, overall, it seems like Americans The majority of Americans are still not pleased with Kamala Harris in general. So I'm going to say, let's give it a little bit more time.
Absolutely.
But we should note, Rick, she's hauled in a whole boatload of money in the past week, almost $250 million, which is now going to turn this 2024 race into the most expensive, potentially most expensive political campaign in U.S. history.
And it's just amazing to think that we talk about these things. I know you and I had talked this morning when we were talking about what we were going to have in the show, And I mentioned this, and I think sometimes we forget these are multimillionaires and billionaires who are essentially buying politicians, because in America, buying a politician is legal. Corruption is legal in the United States political system. You have a right to give millions of dollars to somebody mm-hmm. because you want them to do something for you. And this is what we're seeing happening, not just with Kamala Harris, to be fair, but with Trump as well. And if it was not Kamala Harris and Trump, it would be two other people, and they too would be essentially bought by billionaires and millionaires. That's terrible. Speaking of elections, let's move to Venezuela. Venezuela's election is over, and it appears that the incumbent, President Nicolas Maduro, has won. He is asserting his victory, and his opponents are saying he cheated. Here we go.
Las convocamos. Se realizaron de manera ejemplar.
We called for the elections, and they were made in an exemplary manner. And I can say to Venezuela and to the world, I am Nicolas Maduro, re-elected president of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Thanks for defending our democracy, our laws, and our people.
We want to tell all Venezuelans and the whole world that Venezuela has a new elected president, and it is Edmundo González. We won. Everybody knows it. Everybody knows it. I want you to know that this has been something so overwhelming, so big, that we have won in all sectors of the country.
That's weird. I'm looking at Maduro, and he's dressed like a high school cheerleader. Meanwhile, the guy who supposedly beat him looks like Joe Biden, like he's half asleep. It's bizarre sitting from the outside looking at this election. But the fact of the matter is, it is surprising that Maduro could pull out a victory, given the sad state of his country's economy. Here's renowned economist Jeffrey Sachs, a guy, by the way, that I very much respect because he's willing to tell the truth in the United States of America, a country where the truth is not something you usually get away with saying. He explains why Venezuela's economy is in ruins.
The U.S. government has been trying to strangle the Venezuelan economy. It started with sanctions in 2017 that prevented essentially the country from accessing international capital markets and the oil company from restructuring its loans. That put Venezuela into a hyperinflation. That was the utter collapse. Now Venezuela's in complete, utter catastrophe. A lot of it brought on by the United States deliberately, creating massive, massive suffering. We know there's hunger. We know there's an incredible shortage of medical supplies. We can only imagine, because we won't know really until the dust settles and careful studies are done, how much excess mortality there is. But surely in a context like this, this is a catastrophe largely created by the U.S.
Catastrophe created by the U.S. Where have we seen that before? Manila, I did my own research this morning. I checked out this Edmundo González guy, and what I found was that he is deeply, deeply tied to Washington. He even went to school, the School of the Americas, where the CIA basically trains Latin American leaders to then eventually take over countries. I don't know. Your thoughts on Maduro beating González and the reaction so far from the opposition, including Maria Corina Machado?
Well, Rick, I think what we have witnessed over the years is that the United States and the powers that be here, especially over at the DOD and the State Department, have greatly underestimated the will of the Venezuelan people, as well as that of Nicolas Maduro, who himself, by the way, survived an assassination attempt when he was speaking on stage a couple of years ago. A small drone allegedly was attacking him when he was giving a speech. So he's not only survived an assassination attempt, he's also survived a coup attempt. If you recall, during the Trump administration, they appointed, the U.S., that is, appointed and anointed Juan Guaido to where, you know, a handful of countries, a couple dozen countries decided to recognize him as the temporary president or whatever it was. But that guy's nowhere to be found as well. So to see a Nicolas Maduro victory yet again I think, underscores the resistance and the resilience of the Venezuelan people. And then when you compare that to this Maria Machado woman, she sounds like Hillary Clinton circa 2016, a sore loser, defending her guy, but a sore loser, and using the same playbook and saying, no, we won. The election was stolen, even though the math doesn't pan out in her favor.
You know what I think? I was talking to some of our friends here, many of whom in South Florida are Venezuelan, and I think even they would probably admit that somehow the Venezuelan, because Maduro's no saint, okay? But the Venezuelan opposition needs to come up with something other than a Washington CIA / State Department handpicked opposition person. Because I think you lose your credibility. They should have somebody take on Maduro. They should have somebody try and fix the economy. But if you come in and everything in your background says CIA, State Department, trained in Washington, ex-diplomat, it's like, how can I believe you? I mean, you may be the greatest guy in the world, but everybody else who's come with those same credentials is usually a liar and a usurper. So I think they need to find that person. I'm not sure if Capriles was that person or some of the others that we've covered in the past are that person, but this ain't it, my opinion. I may be wrong.
It ain't Gonzalez.
Yeah, it ain't Gonzalez.
It ain't Gonzalez.
By the way, he looks like Biden. Gonzalez. He looks like Biden. I'm sorry. But she was talking and he was sleeping behind her. The world is still reacting to the opening ceremony of the Olympics. So let me stage it this way for you, the way they did. The opening ceremony gives the host country the chance to kind of show off its wares, right? It is, so to speak, those of you who've watched it in the past, it's usually a beautiful rendition, act. It's a chance to put your stamp as the host country and show the world a little bit of your culture. For example, let me take you back to China. Look at that. That was the Chinese. That was the opening ceremony in 2008, the Summer Olympics in Beijing. 4,000 drummers playing folkloric music of China. It was meant to illustrate China's devotion to its past, an ancient culture that is as complex as it is disciplined. Now let me show you an image of the opening ceremony in Sochi. This is when Russia hosted the Winter Olympics in 2014. They chose to illustrate the country's culture through music and through ballet, which they're famous for, as well as emphasizing the country's history and literature with references to its great writers like Tolstoy and Chekhov. Okay, that brings us to this. This is the image that's being shared around the world, which I guess represents the culture of France and the West. I mean, compare that to what we just saw from the Chinese and from the Russians. I mean, by the way, and I did this for you, above you see the famous Da Vinci painting of, you know, Jesus's Last Supper, and below it is the image broadcast to the world from the opening ceremony in Paris last Friday. Manila, as we're looking at this, can you explain to me what the hell that is that we're looking at, that overweight woman with that thing on her head and all those people? What is this? I didn't see it, by the way. I was at a baseball game. What is this?
I did see it, Rick. I was a little bit appalled myself, but you know, that's me editorializing. So once I remove my editorializing and just trying to be fair and objective about this, one, we have to note that the people that organized this opening ceremony have now come forward, whether it's genuine or not, they have come forward to apologize that its depiction of the Last Supper has offended so many millions of people watching the ceremony around the world, especially those of religious devotion. They were very offended by it, and France got a lot of blowback for it immediately on social media and as well as through official channels. Now, I would say, you know, having been to France multiple times, I have family in France, I would say modern 20th and 21st century, we think of France and we think of fashion and food, haute couture, and I think If I want to, I don't know if I'm playing devil's advocate here, but at least giving the benefit of the doubt to the organizers is that maybe perhaps they thought they were being bold and avant-garde. But we got to remember, if we put this shoe on the other foot, or we put it the other way and say they did a rendition of, I don't know, a show of Muhammad and did something with Muslim themed, they would be deemed Islamophobic, right? And that this would be racist. So, you know, it's hard to justify.
But that's the same thing that's going on now. But that's, I mean, as last I recalled, I don't think Jesus was trans, and I don't think most of the people around him were all gay, and I don't remember any of the prophets wearing, you know, having a beard and wearing a bikini. I don't understand any of that, and I don't understand what they were trying to say, and I think what it's saying is that the Western culture, unlike many cultures in the world, has just kind of gotten out of control, and they don't have any rules or any sense of ethics or morality. I mean, and that's the obvious thing that they seem to be trying to say, and if that's being artsy, then I would prefer not to be artsy, or home couture, or whatever that word is that you just pronounced a little while ago.
Haute couture, in the fashion world.
So. Great. Good for haute couture. Tell him I said hi, old Hody. Listen, thanks, Manila. So you know how we're always, by the way, hearing about the tunnels in Gaza, and it seems that every time the Israeli military bombs and destroys a building, apartments, schools, kills thousands of innocent people, including children, it always says, well, we had to do this because there was a Hamas tunnel underneath there. For example, there's not a single operational hospital left in Gaza. Not a single hospital left in Gaza. That's crazy. Watch this.
These are the sounds of the final gasps from Gaza's collapsing healthcare system. Medical staff in Gaza City working under near relentless Israeli bombardment for over a month. But now, this chorus of frantic voices, seen here working under torchlight, tells its own gut-wrenching story. The Al-Quds Hospital, the second largest in Gaza, has now collapsed.
A hospital collapses. That's crazy. If that happened anywhere else in the world, can you imagine? And yet, another day in Gaza. When we come back, I'm going to be talking to a guest who gives us a different perspective on what those tunnels really represent for the people of Gaza. Fascinating conversation I'm going to have with Gadi Francis. She's wonderful. She's an award-winning international correspondent. She's been on the ground there in the war in Gaza. And it is, in and of itself, an act of courage just to be there, obviously, if anybody looks at the pictures that are coming in. She is going to join us in just a minute. Stay right there, because we're going to be right back. So welcome back, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and this is Direct Impact. I'm so glad that you are there. So joining us now is Gadi Francis. She's the host of the West Asia Post on World is One News, and she is good enough to join us right now. You know, I'm thinking about starting a conversation with something that, for me personally, as a citizen of the United States, made me very angry. I just watched last week as the president of the United States and the vice president of the United States literally turned the government over to this man who came here from Israel and was everything if not domineering and explosive. And he told our politicians what the foreign policy of the United States should be. Mind you, let me repeat this. While the president was sitting at home somewhere and the vice president was being hidden and not even a member of that. That just seems so wrong from an American perspective. 50 to 60% of Americans don't even like this guy, and he's the guy running our government? What do you think of that?
Well, I came across a meme today, I think, on Instagram, and because, you know, the space has been all filled with memes making fun of how the Congress was standing and clapping for the massacre and for the war criminal that is proven by the ICJ, but they still were clapping for him. So everybody's making fun. Today there was a meme saying that they're just clapping to keep their seats. And it's really very accurate. Because if you look at how much the AIPAC and the lobbies and the Zionism rules and governs in terms of money and the deep state in the United States of America, it's not really uncommon to see that happen in the American Congress. I mean, if it weren't for the United States of America, I don't think Benjamin Netanyahu would have weapons to keep on slaughtering kids and to keep on bombing hospitals. The airstrikes are coming. They are made in the United States of America. And if they're not, the impunity and the vetoes and the protection. So actually, to me, I don't see it as a war between us, the indigenous people, and the Israelis. We don't recognize Israel as a state. It's an occupation that has always been helped and funded and governed and held strong by the Americans in the region. So it's not really uncommon. It's just very rude. And the audacity, the bias, I mean, they're still crying over what's happening in Ukraine, although they are the reason for it. They don't even find it in themselves to respect the blood of tens of thousands of people, of civilians. It's very rude, you know?
Yeah, it seemed that way, and it is that way, I think, to many Americans. But unfortunately, it seems like right now, even though we call ourselves a democracy, I'm not sure that our representatives or elected officials represent the will of the American people, so they do whatever the hell they're gonna do, which does make it somewhat hypocritical when we go around the world telling everybody else how they need to be more of a democracy like us, but that doesn't represent democracy. Let me ask you, I've seen a lot of your reporting. You're fantastic. You're just a spitfire when I watch you reporting and the things that you do and how you get in there and you roll up your sleeves and you tell the stories of what's really going on involving real people. I saw some of your reporting on the tunnels in Gaza. And we're always told here in the West that wherever you see a tunnel, it represents Hamas, that there are some Hamas soldiers or terrorists down there planning or something. But you explain in some of your reporting that many of those tunnels are simply the infrastructure that's been used by many Palestinians for many years because they're kind of possessed, oppressed people, and that's the only way they can do certain things. Kind of like the way the Underground Railroad worked for African-American slaves, African-Americans, blacks, during the Civil War, prior to the Civil War in the United States. Can you take us through that explanation a little bit?
I think now it's very obvious to the world how the Israelis look at the people in Gaza. I mean, they are denying aid and they are actually causing a starvation. And as we speak now, there's a polio epidemic in Gaza. So the Israelis do not give rights to anyone, and they do not regard them as humans. The time that I entered Gaza, Rick, it was there wasn't war. It was just being an open air prison. This is what Amnesty International and the United Nations called Gaza before that war, before October 7, years and years ago, because they have been besieged. And the only way that I, as a journalist, could get there was through a tunnel. And the only way that anybody could get there was through a tunnel, because the Egyptians have closed Rafah borders. It's not possible to get inside or outside. So there were about thousands, more than 1,500 tunnels, as per the reports and the investigative reporting that I did at the time. And these were only lifelines for medicine, for food, for humans, for anybody that needed to move around. Now, I don't think there's any human that would prefer to live like that. So and it's really very unfair and unjust when we speak about the tunnels as terrorism or Hamas, without speaking that these humans, even before Hamas was born, they were being persecuted and oppressed and occupied and killed and slaughtered and raped and jailed and imprisoned. And actually, Hamas or any kind of resistance today is the reaction. The action is the occupation of the land, the colonization of the people, the slaughter of kids. And this has been happening here since 1948 and before. So the tunnels are just one more thing in that narrative. It's a reaction to the oppression and to the imprisonment of civilians and of millions of people in an open-air prison.
Do you think that Netanyahu will continue to expand this war and go beyond Gaza? Do you think with what we've seen in Yemen and obviously in Lebanon that this thing will actually metastasize?
Actually, I don't think that Netanyahu really knows what he's doing or really has the options. Right now, as we speak, they are really there's a hot potato being thrown left, right, and center inside the Israeli governance of their occupation and their colony here. I mean, today they were kicked out from Majd al-Shams, ministers, right ministers. Today, the police, the Israeli police and the Israeli soldiers clashed in Sidi Timan when they were trying to arrest them. But and every day there are protests and there's an instability and there's the hostages' families. So in general, Netanyahu is looking for a way out, and he has in mind his own political career, because there's no way out of here. There's no way for him to get out of here. And on the other hand, there's something, Rick, the Israelis have always been saying, ever since the dawn of my memory of them, they've been saying, they want to eradicate us. They want to annihilate us. They want to annex our land, Lebanon, Palestine, and Syria. So they never want peace. The only time when they're not actually bombing us is when they cannot, because the power of the resistance now is really deterring. And the only reason why Netanyahu would not expand is his inability to do so.
There were some Jewish Americans last week who were protesting Netanyahu's visit. And one young man, and we played his soundbite here on our show, said, I was a little boy growing up as a Jew, and I was always told the Holocaust, never again. We can never let it happen. And then he went on to say, now I'm seeing it happen again, and it's my people who are acting and doing it. And I thought, wow, never quite heard it put that way, but I thought that was a very powerful and pronounced message. You are a powerful and pronounced messenger, Gadi, and it's such a pleasure to have you on with us. I can't wait to get you back, because I'd like for the conversation to go on further. I have a feeling you have a lot of things that you want to share. Thanks again.
Thank you.
That's our show. Remember to always look outside your own box. Truths don't live in boxes. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll be looking for you next time.